Welcome along to the Bodywise podcast. Today's guest joins us from Michigan State University to talk about the role of socioeconomic disadvantage. Welcome, Blair. Can you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Blair Burnett. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology in the Clinical Sciences area at Michigan State University.
We know it's very hard to unstick myths about mental illnesses, mental health issues, and you and some colleagues have written a piece, The Ignored Role of Disadvantage in Eating Disorders. Part of this includes where you tackle a long-established myth about affluence and eating disorders. And can you say a little bit about that, also the acronym SWAG and the idea of, quote, the golden girl?
Yeah, so there have been these prevailing stereotypes, you know, for decades, if not longer, certainly dating back to the 50s and earlier, that the primary people who get eating disorders are the SWAG stereotype, essentially, is skinny, white, affluent girls. But this idea that young, thin, cisgender, affluent women get eating disorders. And really, that comes from these case reports that were based, you know, in Europe and America, where we based our entire diagnostic criteria on these case reports of young, you know, thin, upper class white women, the people who are basically presenting to psychiatric services for eating concerns. And so that really biased how we thought about eating disorders for a long time. And I think, you know, it makes sense that the people who were presenting for services, especially before really there was awareness about eating disorders, were the people who had the means and the ability to go and receive services for their mental health, especially back in the 50s, 60s. So that stereotype has been really sticky, as you mentioned, and has prevailed for decades.
Your article also addresses food insecurity and the mechanisms, the role it plays in the development of eating disorders.
Yeah, and I think that's an emerging area of research, and I think we're still trying to understand what the mechanisms are there and what could be playing a role. But I think there's a lot of good data there, and I think there's a lot of plausible hypotheses about what's going on. And I think anyone who also engages in clinical practice has really seen this show up anecdotally. But I think some of the mechanisms and the things that could be going on is that food insecurity can really mimic periods of famine, right? I mean, that is essentially what it is that someone is going through periods of like starvation, semi-starvation, or restriction where they don't have adequate food. And then they may have times where food is available again. And so it can lead to what in the literature is sometimes called the feast or famine hypothesis, but that when food is available, that someone is eating as much as they can. And I think if you think about this just biologically, if you don't know when food will be available again, then it makes sense that you would eat as much as you could, you know, when it is available, and that would just be adaptive. You know, there is research that shows that when you go through periods of restriction, that it can increase your attentional biases to food cues. So you're more likely to notice food in your environment, which again makes sense as adaptive. Like your body is trying to get you to notice that food's available so that you can eat because it needs to eat. There's also that food can become more rewarding when it is available, especially like food that's going to be a good bang for your buck energy wise. And that again makes sense. It's adaptive that you would be rewarded for eating food that's like giving your body a lot of nutrients or quick energy or whatever the case may be. But, you know, over time, the thing that can happen is that people may learn to eat according to food availability versus natural biological, you know, cues of hunger and satiety. And those cues can even get dysregulated in the context of food insecurity or periods of restriction. And so we're beginning to see this robust link between food insecurity and disordered eating behaviors. The most studied link has definitely been between food insecurity and binge eating. But food insecurity has also been linked to, you know, restriction and compensatory behaviors. We know that people who are experiencing poverty often have like higher BMI. And in this culture that is saturated with weight stigma and that basically says like larger bodies are worse and you know, less attractive, less healthy, then it would make sense too that we might see a link between then food insecurity and weight and shape concerns or food insecurity and restrictive behaviors or compensatory behaviors. So I think there's a lot going on there, but those are some of the mechanisms that could be underlying this association that we're seeing between food insecurity and disordered eating.
And you capture that then in an infographic in the paper, Putative Mechanisms Linking Food Insecurity and Eating Disorders.
Right, yeah.
There was also reference kind of to the contextual issues that might be going on for someone. So, for example, it talks about, you know, neighborhood resources, safety, how close they are to a grocery store, fast food availability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the neighborhood, like what is available to you, the grocery stores, fresh produce, the types of food that are available to you. We don't have a lot of good research on that in the eating disorder literature, I don't think. But, you know, there are concerns that certain types of food are less satisfying, less satiating, that you may be less likely to know when you're like full from them. So, that's something that could be going on. But certainly the resources that are available to you in your environment is going to affect like what foods you eat, and certainly part of the picture.
There was a paper early during COVID as well that talked about people being worried about going to the supermarket out of fear of being judged for what they were buying, or safe foods as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of stigma there for sure. There's also, you know, some data that people with food insecurity experience so much stigma and discrimination that can be a barrier to accessing needed resources and food related assistance. So that stigma that it carries can even prevent people from getting the food that they need.
Why and how do we need to think about disadvantage in a multidimensional way?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times we think of disadvantage as just being poverty, and that's really oversimplifying it, and it's missing the bigger picture, because research shows that different aspects of disadvantage are differentially related to symptoms and risk. And so, you know, we have disadvantage at that like individual and family level, and that certainly plays a role. So like food insecurity happening within the household is directly affecting that individual and can affect how they're eating, and ultimately long-term downstream have effects on the eating behaviors that they develop and their eating concerns. But there are other aspects of disadvantage that could potentiate risk for disordered eating. So there's neighborhood disadvantage. And so again, we're talking about access, what kinds of food people have access to, the availability of fresh produce, grocery store availability. But then there's also like neighborhood cohesion and how close people feel to their neighbors and how much they're looking out for one another, crime and violence in the neighborhood, which could, you know, increased risk for trauma experiences. Then we have school disadvantage. So we have, you know, factors such as, you know, if the school has free lunch, so the food that's available. But then, you know, both neighborhood and school affect variables like education attainment and then downstream employment like attainment. And so kind of how far someone can get in their education and the employment opportunities are going to be available to them. So they're each of those levels could potentially have different effects on someone's like eating disorder risk. But there's also evidence that cumulatively, so like one aspect of disadvantage could be uniquely associated with disordered eating risk, but cumulatively too, if someone's experiencing multiple forms of disadvantage, that could escalate their risk. And we do see some evidence that, you know, youth who experience disadvantage at key parts of their development, so when, you know, in their childhood and early adolescence, that disadvantage can shift that curve of genetic risk. And so we might see an increased risk for disordered eating earlier in life. And that can be particularly harmful because we know that for young people, early intervention is one of the best predictors of good outcomes in eating disorder treatment. And for people who are living in disadvantaged contexts, if they don't have access, like if they're living in a rural neighborhood or they're living in a city that doesn't have eating disorders, you know, services, they may not even be able to access treatment, or they might financially not be able to access it. Biases about who eating disorders affect are also going to affect whether, you know, they're taken seriously or they're identified by providers. And so I think we have to look at these different components of disadvantage and see how they uniquely and jointly contribute to disordered eating risk, because these are youth that are already going to be at a disadvantage for receiving needed treatment that can help, you know, improve their, you know, prognosis and eating disorder treatment, or could contribute to the chronicity of their symptoms.
What do we know about the gap between research and practice, as noted in the conclusion of the article?
I mean, I think that's a prevailing problem across most areas, probably. I mean, of mental health, certainly, but probably more broadly. You know, I think what we see right now is we have so much data that eating disorders affect people across gender, across race, across ethnicity, age, weight status, and certainly socioeconomic status. And I think we've had a lot of an explosion of research about that over the last like decade or so. So we know that, and we're starting to see increased research about what are the risk factors for these groups. What's unique? What's uniquely predicting risk in these groups? What's predicting, you know, what are protective factors in these groups? How did eating disorders show up in different groups, because we know the most about how do eating disorders present in young, thin, affluent white women, and how do we treat eating disorders thin and young, thin, affluent white women. So we have more and more research saying these things do affect other groups. It might look like this. These are some unique things to consider, but actually changing practice is slow. And so we still mostly use the same measurement tools that were developed back in the 80s, for instance, like the eating disorder examination and the eating disorder examination questionnaire were developed in the 80s. And so that was when we knew less about that, but we're still using that measure a lot, and we're using measures based on that, or the SCOF, the 5-item screening tool for disordered eating, was developed, I think, in the 90s. I could be wrong. So we're still using these older tools that may not capture how eating disorders present in other groups. And then that affects who, you know, meets criteria for research trials. And so change in actually how eating disorder treatment is delivered has been really slow, changing potentially what eating disorder treatments target or consider. Like, there's no current evidence-based eating disorder treatment that targets, you know, food insecurity or has a module for that, for instance. We're just learning about that. And so that practice side is really slow to catch up. But I think it's really crucial. And, you know, I think even to the degree I did a systematic review a couple of years ago where we found that 80% of participants in eating disorder treatment trials were white, and in the United States, and 90% were female. And so, you know, we put that review out with some recommendations of basically how can we do better? How can we increase inclusion in our treatment trials so that we know whether our existing treatments work for other groups or whether we need to adapt or develop new interventions? But for that to happen, people have to change their, you know, recruitment practices. For instance, in our study, we found that far and away the most common way that researchers were recruiting their participants was clinical referrals. But to be referred by a clinician, you have to present for treatment, right? And a clinician has to see that person likely has an eating disorder or might qualify. And so there's so many biases that would prevent someone from even getting to that point. And so I think we have to change how we do research, and we have to prioritize these things. And there are people who are doing that. For instance, Tiffany Brown and some of her colleagues recently developed an eating disorder treatment for LGBTQ young adults, I think. And so people are starting to do that, but it's slow and it's lagging behind, I think, what we know about eating disorders.
It does feel like we're in a time where a lot of the norms of the field are being challenged a little bit. And in other areas, often, again, people might not like the language atypical presentations, or people who don't fall within the current diagnostic category.
Yeah, things are definitely being challenged, and there's definitely, minds are changing. It's just now starting to change how we go. That's the harder part, right? Changing how we go about things, changing how do we recruit participants for trials. It's going to be harder. It's easier to say to your clinician network, let me know if you have people who might meet criteria for this trial. It's harder work to go into a community and say, hey, how can we reach you, and what are the best method? It's harder. It takes more time. It takes more resources. And so I think sometimes with the culture and academia of publish and get it out and get as many grants as possible, that pressure to publish and get grants and quickly, I think, can make it hard for people to take their time. But that's ultimately what we need. We need to change how we go about it if we want to get different results.
Finally, then, is there anything else you wish to add?
I don't think so.
Thank you very much, Blair, for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That concludes this episode. You can find a reference to Blair's research in the show notes. Thank you for listening.